Hello and welcome to How Many Geese? I'm Jack Badhams.
And I'm Roddy Shaw.
And if you're looking for a nature podcast that doesn't take itself too seriously,
then we are The Natural Selection.
On today's show,
he is the highest military rank penguin in the world.
She'd grab a penguin, she'd drown it, and she was just like stacking penguins on his head.
No, but most penguins don't live on snowy and icy. Yeah. That is a Christmas card that's been sold to you and, as penguins being on ice.
And you've bought it hook, line and sinker, Badhams.
Listener, we on How Many Geese are not known for half-arsing things. And today, as you are already well aware, we do not need to tell you that today is World Penguin Day. So where better to come for World Penguin Day than Europe's largest penguin pool? We're at Edinburgh Zoo to see the penguins, aren't we, Roddy?
We are. We're deep in penguins. We couldn't navigate this conversation on our own.
No.
So how better to learn about penguins at Edinburgh Zoo than enlisting Edinburgh Zoo's finest, Michael Livingston? Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Now, could you tell us a little bit more about who you are and what you do here?
Yes, I'm a senior animal keeper here, and I look after the carnivores and penguins. So it's a bit of a
first. Yeah, let's just before we go any further, who in their right mind thought grouping the carnivores and the penguins was a good idea?
Yeah, so it's a bit of an odd mashup, but it's nice to do something a bit different. And with all the bird flu and avian flu stuff, it's good for our biosecurity to have our penguins completely separate from our other bird species, so that there's no crossover with them.
So you don't want your other bird keepers really coming in with the penguins. You want to try and keep those separate.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So is every bird keeper at the zoo paired with a bird and a non... Like, did all the birds used to be looked after one team and then bird flu, and they were like, okay, penguins, you're now doing carnivores. Cassowary, you're now doing the antelopes, and sort of matched you all out so there's no...
Kind of. We used to have a bird section, and now it's a bit separate. So we do have a birds and primates, which look after the majority of our birds, and on our hoofstock section, they've got some birds as well. So we work it so that we only have... Each day has one keeper that only goes into one bird enclosure, so they're not...
Going
into multiple bird enclosures so that we can keep them as separate as we can.
Fantastic. I almost feel we've jumped in right at the deep end with bird flu.
Right to the hard stuff.
Well, let's go back then. Bird enclosures. We are looking at a mighty fine bird enclosure here that is full of penguins. How many penguins and what species are we talking about?
We have over 130 penguins.
What?
So, yeah, it doesn't look like it, but there's a lot of penguins over there.
Yeah.
we've got king penguins, gentoo penguins, and rockhopper penguins.
Now, I want to use this moment to address a bit of an elephant in the room. Because I have said before on this podcast, as a bird person, an ardent bird person, that penguins don't really do it for me. And I want to just say that my experience of penguins, and especially your zoo penguins, have been, I'm going to say, the lesser penguins. Because you go to a zoo, and the penguin that you see is the African penguins. I don't think I've been to a zoo and seen... These are proper Antarctic penguins, aren't they? These are like your king penguins, your gentoo penguins. They're proper cool penguins, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got the best ones here.
Yeah, like these are proper hardcore penguins that are like living out there in Antarctica. So we can see in front of us now... We've got a little group of the king penguins, which are the big tall ones with the orange cheeks. Is that their cheeks? Not really their cheeks, is it? Orange on
the side of their heads. Yeah.
And then we've got they're the gentoo penguins with the white heads.
Yeah, that's right.
And they're all on nests.
Yes. So we're slap bang in the middle of our gentoo breeding season. Mm. So they're all in their nests. They've got eggs. Some are sultily. Some eggs are about to hatch soon in the next few days. So, yeah, we're fully into the madness that is our gentoo breeding season.
So, with 130 penguins, how are... If I wanted... Okay, we've come to Europe's biggest penguin pond. But if I wanted to start an even bigger penguin pond, how do I go about getting a... Like, are the 130 penguins you have they all been bred in the zoo? Right the way down, so is this like the fifth generation of Edinburgh's penguins with the breeding you're doing, or are you constantly getting new penguins in and out from other zoos?
Yeah, a bit of both. So we're part of Edinburgh Zoo is part of EASA, which is the European association that you have member zoos and aquariums, and as part of our membership we are part of breeding programs that are run on a European level. So our king penguin, in fact all our three species, are run by what's called a stud bookkeeper, and they look after the population as a whole, looking at the genetics, and each species has its own goals for depending on what the needs are for that species. So we are part of that, and I am the stud bookkeeper for the king penguin, so I run that, and one of my colleagues is a gentoo penguin.
That's
so
cool.
We look after those populations as a whole, and through that zoos will move penguins, or in this case penguins, between different zoos and aquariums that hold them, to move either the genetics around so you don't have a lot of related birds that could pair up with each other, and if there's any places that are looking for more birds in their enclosure and things like that. So there's multiple reasons why they might move them about, but that's how we have our colony is bred up through our own breeding over the years, but we also occasionally have birds that will leave to go to other places and birds that will come to us.
So in practice, when you say you're the stud bookkeeper, does that mean you essentially know the family history and the lineages of all the king penguins in captivity that are a member of EASA?
Yeah, that's right. So we've it's on our computer system, and we use that, so whenever there's any hatches or any deaths, it's all logged, and we can see the population as a whole, we can see the lineages of who's related to who and where they are and things like that.
How many king penguins are in Europe in the EASA system?
Around 340.
Wow, that's more than I thought, because they're not something that you come across very often in captivity. When you see the penguins, like I said, the king penguins, the really cool tall ones. And are there any emperor penguins in captivity?
There is. I think they're mainly found in America because they need cold. So they need to be in an enclosure that's environmentally controlled. So it has to be really low
levels. Cold.
Really cold for them, because they're proper Arctic penguins. So proper Antarctic penguins. Sorry.
Now, talking about the breeding of them here, all these penguins that we can see on their nest, the gentoo penguins, I think some of our listeners may be aware of something that these penguins do, because there's been a fair few viral clips of these penguins when it comes to what they're making their nests out of, because they've got piles of stones.
Yep.
And I've seen, there's definitely been some, I don't know whether it was David Attenborough or whatever, sequences of these penguins gifting stones and stealing stones and all that sort of stuff. And I can see out here, they're on these like little concrete plinths, but then there's a pile of stones in there. So do they here gift the stones to each other? Are they stealing them from each other's nests? And what's the deal with the stones?
Yeah, the stones cause a lot of drama in the penguin world, in the gentoo penguin world. So yeah, they build their nests out of the stones. We provide the stones with them. So when it comes to mid-February, we normally use Valentine's Day as our kind of marker.
Right.
And we put all the nest rings out, and then we start putting in the stones, and then they will pair up. We have a lot of pairs that will pair up consistently every year, and they will use the stones to build their nest. They use the stones to flirt with each other. They kind of gift it. But yeah, there's always lots of dramas around the stones. They will steal it. There's been research done to show that penguins will flirt with other birds just to get closer nests, so they can steal stones for their nests and things like that. So yeah, it's all about the stones.
We've seen it happening here already. When we arrived, we saw a couple penguins running around with stones going from nest to nest. If you have to send a gentoo penguin to another zoo because of the stud book work, do you send its favourite stone with it?
No.
Yeah, that's a level that's maybe a bit too much.
The stud book for stones.
All linked up.
A little satchel that they leave with.
Exactly.
Oh, they would look very cute with that little satchel, the way they walk around.
Yeah, packing it on its way at the airport. Off you go.
Now, in this big enclosure, you've got the gentoo and the kings together. And then I note that the rockhoppers are sort of off to one side.
Yep.
Is there a reason they've been set? Are they, are they, you know, given your experience now as a carnivore keeper, is there something about rockhoppers we don't know? Why are they in a separate enclosure?
They are separate because that's where they nest. So normally they are together, and they're out of breeding season times, they're together in the main enclosure. But they are breeding at the moment, so our rockhoppers are the first ones out of the three species that we have to start their breeding season, so their nest strings are up in that enclosure. Yeah. So we move them through for their breeding, and then once they're all finished and once the gentoos are kind of finished their breeding season, then they all move back into the same enclosure.
And the rockhoppers, for people who might not know, they're the ones with the... They're really funky. I don't know how to describe their...
In the Surf's Up movie,
that's where I was going.
One of the penguins, it's got the jazzy head feathers.
That's where I was going, Surf's Up. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure they're probably in Happy Feet. Was it Robin Williams in Happy Feet? He might have been a rockhopper.
Yeah, we're getting nods on the sidelines.
Okay, there we go. Robin Williams in Happy Feet, that's our cultural touchstone.
So how many chicks would you hope to have in a year across all three, either individually or
So it kind of depends. So with our rockhoppers, they are our most endangered species that we have. They are critically endangered, I'm pretty sure is what they're classed as. So any rockhopper chick is precious, and we do our very best to get as many of them as we can. We had two last year, we had two the year before. We're hopeful. I have my money on four this year, so we'll see. Yeah. We'll see how that goes. With our gentoos, last year we had 16 chicks. Mm-hmm. We did very well last year, but just because an egg is fertile doesn't mean it's going to finish developing. Yeah. Enclosure space as well, it's a big thing that we have to keep in our mind. Now, we have a big enough enclosure for over 200 penguins, so we don't have, you know, we're not that limited on space, but we don't want to be completely overrun. So we do kind of manage our breeding with our gentoo penguins as well.
Yeah.
And how many kings?
Kings, we have five kings. They're all boys. So,
so no baby kings.
No breeding there. Hopefully, I don't know, maybe in the future we'll have some ladies for them, but we'll see. But yeah, we've just got our wee bachelor group of males at the moment.
And one of them looks like it's still got some of the fluffy downy feathers on it. Is that quite a young one in there?
No, so our kings are just coming out of their molting. So the penguins do the catastrophic molt, where they
catastrophic molt.
Yeah, that's what it's called. So they molt all of their feathers at once, because they obviously need their feathers to be waterproof and protect them from the cold waters, because that's where they find their food. So unlike other bird species who might molt the odd feather out throughout the year, they need to do it all at the same time because they're not waterproof when they molt.
So do they not go in the water then?
So they don't really go in the water, no.
When we got here, we were waiting and we saw the four fluffy, slightly raggedy looking king penguins on the sidelines, and there was one king penguin having an absolute whale of the time in the pond, splashing and flipping and spinning. And at first we thought king penguin's a bit crazy, but now I'm maybe thinking, was he actually showboating to the others who can't yet go in the water?
Yeah, he's like, I'm finished.
Exactly.
Yeah, that was probably Niels, to be fair. He molted first, so he's looking very swish. And
is he
normally
the orange band?
Purple band.
Well, this is very much bringing us on to, because not only do you have the biggest penguin enclosure, not only do you have over 130 penguins, but could you tell us a little bit about just who Niels is?
Niels is our very special king penguin. He is the highest military rank penguin in the world. He is a mascot for Norwegian King's Guard.
Yep.
And he has quite the title to go with it.
I was going to say, we're saying Niels. Can we give him his full title?
Yes. He is, I need to remember it now, Major General Sir Niels Olav, Knight and Baron of Bouvet Island.
I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, there's no other penguin that's coming close to that, is that? And how does that work? How does that work in practice? What was he given his stately honours for?
So the story goes back to when Edinburgh Zoo first got king penguins, and our first very long, long time ago, we got our first king penguins from they were brought to us from a Norwegian ship.
Oh.
And Niels Eglien, who I believe was the king at the time, he saw how nice they looked, how proper and regal they looked, and likened them to his King's Guard. So they kind of became a mascot to the Norwegian King's Guard.
Right.
So that's where he gets his name from. And he has just been given knighthood and titles.
Because he keeps
land,
getting promoted, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Because he was a brigadier.
Land. Land. Well, he's well, Baron of Bouvier Island. Bouvier Island. So he's
literally the Baron
of
that Bouvier
island.
Island.
Yeah. So he's
we are not worthy.
Yeah, he's quite the special penguin. So whenever we have the tattoo and the Norwegian Kingsguard come to Edinburgh for the tattoo, they quite often come to the zoo. And last year was when he became Major General, so we had the full get up. We had a whole line of the Norwegian Guard up the side of the enclosure. There was a military band. He's got medals that are specially made that clip onto his flipper band and everything.
Way.
So yeah, he's very special. He definitely knows it. He walks around that enclosure like he's better than the other penguins sometimes, and flirts with the keepers quite a lot, to be fair. But he's a very special.
Has he ever been to Norway?
No.
He'd be welcomed as a king. And how old is he? Do we know how old he is?
Niels is 22.
And what's the sort of rough lifespan of the king penguins?
I think 11 to the 30s.
So is he the first penguin to hold the title?
No, he's the third.
He's the third.
Niels will have the third, yes.
And is that his dad was Niels the second, that dad was Niels the first?
No, it's not quite
that hereditary
lineage
okay.
like that, yes.
Like James Bond.
Yeah. It's rebooted every time.
So if we've still got, you know, if Niels has still got a good few years left in him, where does this end? King of Norway, Prime Minister.
Well, his current title is the third highest, so.
So he's got two more.
No, he's gonna reach the top soon, and then who knows?
Has he been given any kind of brief on what he needs to do to secure that promotion?
His duties,
his KPIs for the year.
Yeah, we had a look. We saw on his most recent promotion, the justification was something like setting a good example to the rest of the penguins, something like that, wasn't it? Was quite sweet.
How do the other king penguins feel?
Not worthy.
Yeah. Or do you think they're eyeing him up for when he does go, so that
they're
can
like,
get the...
Oh, maybe I'll be the next one.
Exactly.
Sort of a Julius Caesar scenario going on one morning when you come down,
stabbed in the back with a frozen haddock.
Keeper up there.
Oh yes, yeah, there he is. So there's a keeper in currently right now.
Yeah,
feeding all the. And what is it that there is it a particular kind of fish, or are they just happy with anything?
Whiting. We use blue whiting.
Okay, so there, and then Niels is just up there hanging around.
Yeah, he quite often comes as soon as he sees us up in the enclosure. He'll come over and follow us and just sidle up next to us, and then he at this time of year, because so king penguins will molt and then they go into their breeding season, while as the rockhoppers and the gentoos will have their breeding season then molt. So because he's molted, he's feeling fresh, he's getting ready to head into his breeding season, and like I said, he quite often flirts with the keepers quite a lot, so he'll spend a lot of time with us when we're up there and sidle up to us, and that kind of like call-ins, we call it like trumpeting kind of thing. Yep. So he'll reach up, there he goes again.
He's loud. It's a loud sound.
Yeah, you can hear him up further up in the zoo.
Yeah.
So I think the last question from me is just, are there any plans to get any female king penguins?
Hopefully, in the near future we'll have some ladies to come and join our boys and see. We are we have had female king penguins in the past. I think 2009 was our last chick that we had born here. So
would they breed in the same way that emperors do, where they balance the egg on their feet, or is it a different way that the king penguins do?
Yeah, so it's similar. So king penguins don't build a nest. So they will hold the egg on their feet, and they will have it in their pouch, and that's the incubator, and then they will swap it between the males and females as well. So they'll kind of just pick a spot where they want to, and then they'll get really grumpy and
just stand there,
shout
at
you if you get too close.
How long would it take them to incubate? Are they stood like literally in one spot for like a month?
So their incubation is about 35 days. So they'll move around a bit, but they won't move around a lot.
Yeah,
it'd be quite hard to move around bouncing an egg on your feet.
Amazing.
Oh, and actually, because we sort of dove into it at the start, but maybe just for any listeners who aren't aware, could you just tell us a little bit about bird flu? you mentioned there was, you were split up, you were doing the carnivores and split up with the deer. What is bird flu? What's the situation? And yeah, anything there?
How might it affect the penguins?
Yeah.
In the UK anyway, we didn't really have bird flu a few years ago, and then, as you will be aware, and I'm sure a lot of other people are aware, they kind of devastated bird populations all over the place. One of our closest wild bird populations was in Bass Rock down North Berwick. Yeah. The, you know, the gannets and stuff there absolutely got annihilated by it. So we, because we are a zoo and we have a duty of care, obviously to our animals, that we have a lot of extra biosecurity things in place that we can make sure that it's not spreading in the zoo or anything like that. And it is, I think it's reportable. I mean, it is reportable. So if we have any bird deaths around the zoo, then we need to report it, and it's kind of looked into. We are, our vets and the keepers were, you know, were really on it and looking at where cases of bird flu are found in the UK, and as it, if it was to get closer, then there would be like kind of different zonage that we would look out for and things like that. So us splitting the penguins off of having like one central bird section is one of our ways that we can really make sure that we're not, if the worst was to happen, we were to get in the zoo, that we weren't going to be able to pass on round the different birds that we have, and our biosecurity is just upped and upped and upped as well. So we have lots of foot dips. We don't, if a keeper's looked after or been in a bird enclosure, then they are not allowed to go in another bird enclosure unless they completely change their uniform, and we wear waterproofs and things like that. So yeah, we put a lot of effort into making sure that we're, you know, really keeping on top of things with it.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. Thank you. Absolutely fabulous. And we're going to go take a look at Sir Neil's.
Yes, and please pass on our regards.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been a good word for you.
Cheers. Thank you very much. It's time for a new little segment that we're dropping into the show this week as we welcome new sponsors, MPB Photography. Now, MPB is the largest global platform to buy, sell and trade used video and photo gear. So that's all sorts of stuff. Cameras of all kinds, lighting, memory cards, batteries, even binoculars and spotting scopes for looking for your wildlife. But as always, we want to put a little goose spin on any sponsorship feature that we do. So we're going to use this MPB segment as our Mad Photography Bite. See what I did there? See what I did there, everybody? And we're going to share a crazy wildlife photography related story. Okay? Now, given that today's episode is all penguin related, how many geese's first Mad Photography Bite is coming to us from Antarctica? And if penguins were our bunch of superheroes, this would be their Thanos.
Okay.
What animal do you think we're talking about?
Oh, I see what you've done. Sorry, for a moment, I thought the photographer was Thanos.
No. No.
Okay, it's a leopard seal.
It's leopard seals. Yeah, we're talking leopard seals. Around 3 meter long and weighing anywhere up to 500 kilos. So we're talking about, like, the apex predator of Antarctica. And although very rare, leopard seals have been known to attack, and even in one case, kill humans. But in 2006, there was a photographer called Paul Nicklin who went down to Antarctica with the aim to show another side of their character. And he ended up taking some pictures which have gone on to become a quite well-known set.
Oh, the, I know the one you mean, where they're doing pottery and knitting and, yeah.
It's the Calendar Girls one.
Exactly. Tastefully posing in front of some tea cakes.
So, Paul went down to Antarctica. And on their first day there, they find this huge female leopard seal, which was bigger than the 12-foot rib that they were in. So they were in a small Zodiac boat, and this leopard seal, a huge female leopard seal, bigger than that boat, longer, tearing a penguin apart. And he was being guided by a Swedish guy called Göran Elmer, who told him that now was the time to get into the water, and gave him this fantastic piece of advice, which was, if you get scared, just close your eyes and the leopard seal will disappear. I watched a video of Paul recounting this tale, and he was talking about how, you know, his mouth was like really dry and it was just this
really terrifying moment where he got in the water with this giant seal. But he was there to do this mission. He dived in. The first thing the seal did, not to calm the situation down at all, was come right up to him and put its mouth over the entire camera. And one of the images that's become quite well known from this set is basically just you're looking straight down a leopard seal's mouth, and you can see its giant teeth, and it's holding on to like the lens of the camera. After a couple of minutes of this threat display, though, it wasn't crunching the camera. It was just a bit of a, you know, like animals often do. What is this? Go away.
Put it in my mouth.
Put it in my mouth. Leave me alone. But then it became really relaxed and went away. Paul thought that that was it, that it was all over. It disappeared off into the abyss. And then a few minutes later, she came back with a penguin. The penguin was still alive and she was holding it by the feet. She brought it closer to Paul and let it go so that the penguin would swim in his direction, but obviously it just swam round him and carried on. So she went and grabbed it again, brought it back to Paul, let it go, repeated it, went and brought it back, kept bringing it 10 times. She released this penguin and kept bringing it back to Paul. And it suddenly dawned on Paul that she was trying to feed him the penguin.
She really wanted him to get the shot.
Yeah. Well, that's what he says in this talk he gives. He's got this really cool shot of like the leopard seal sort of in the background and the penguin swimming right in front of him. And he says, I'm not going to stand here and be one of those photographers that tell you this was a once in a lifetime shot. He was like, this happened so many times that, you know, I could have got this at any point. So the leopard seal would then go and get other penguins, make them really, really exhausted, and just bring them to Paul, and was just like, take this penguin. And it got to the extent that she would then swim off, she'd grab a penguin, she'd drown it, and she'd just dump it on his head. And she was just like stacking penguins on his head. And it got to the stage that she got so frustrated, I want to show you this picture that he took of the leopard seal's response when he sort of wasn't engaging with eating the penguins. So the most disgruntled leopard seal you've ever seen.
Yeah, that is so unimpressed.
Just there's a floating dead chin strap penguin just right above his camera lens.
Yep.
And the leopard seal just looking at him sort of a bit infuriated as to why her gifts are not being so well received. But it was an extraordinary interaction, and before this, leopard seals has always just been seen as, you know, these absolutely demon creatures.
Them bringing dead penguin after dead penguin after dead penguin is meant to change that image. This is a rework of the leopard seal's PR profile.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in terms of showing your affections, it is maybe one of the most psychopathic ways. But I think the thought behind it is nice. She's got a good heart, that leopard seal.
And a passion for the arts.
And it, like I say, it has gone on to become quite a famous set of pictures. He took it in 2006, but it's recently, only the last few years, like resurfaced on social media and things like that. It's become quite big. And it showed a different side to these leopard seals. And extraordinarily, all happened within, you know, he was only with this leopard seal for 2 days, and she just immediately seemed to take a shining to old Paul. So,
well,
yeah, amorous side of the leopard seal. So, whether you're planning on diving into frozen Antarctic waters with a leopard seal or something a little less extreme, then make sure you check out MPB for all your camera needs. They're the simple, safe, and circular way to trade, upgrade, and get paid for your gear. How about that for a little bit of advertising line? Now, and on that note, let's get back to penguins that are in a little bit of a better shape than the ones being dumped on Paul's head.
Happy World Penguin Day to us all.
All right, so we have found ourselves now from the glory of Europe's largest penguin pool in a little office squidged into a room full of charts and maps and all sorts of stuff, because we're going to be coming at you now, listener, with some hardcore science.
Yep, we've gone down the road that said staff only.
Yes. Yeah.
And it led us to a porter cabin.
Yeah, full of all sorts of diagrams and everything. And in this porter cabin, who have we found?
Dr. Heather Ritchie Parker.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Could you just tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. I am Dr. Heather Ritchie Parker, and I am a research scientist at the RSS Wild Genes team. that just means that my expertise are in genetic analysis, usually for species that are of conservation interests that are tied to RZSS, the Royal Zoological Society of Scotland.
Fantastic. So when we were at the penguin pool mm-hmm. with Michael earlier, he was letting us know that you've got the gentoos, the kings and the rockhoppers. Mm-hmm. And we understand that of those three, it's the rockhoppers which are particularly endangered and of focus.
Yes. So rockhoppers are actually three different species of rockhoppers. The species that we have are the northern rockhopper penguins, and they are endangered on the IUCN red list. And the reason for that is that their populations in the wild have declined by over 57% in the last 30 years.
Wow. And where, when we say in the wild, where are we talking?
That's a good question, because it's maybe not that obvious. So these penguins are found on the Tristan da Cunha Islands. So they're in the southern Atlantic. So that is the main Tristan da Cunha Island, which is a nice link to Edinburgh because their capital is Edinburgh of the Seven Seas.
Is it?
Yeah.
Did you know about this? Because your eyes lit up when Tristan da Cunha.
Yeah, came. Tristan da Cunha is one of these sort of British overseas mm-hmm. territories, strange little islands, but it's not the most remote inhabited place in the world, because I think that's the Pitcairn Islands, but it's one of the, it's just one a rock in the middle of nowhere. I think Napoleon was sent there on prison. There's some connection to Napoleon being sent there for prison as well, but yeah, it's Edinburgh of the Seven Seas, I think named after the Duke of Edinburgh. I think there's a connection to the Duke of Edinburgh somehow.
So there's a town on it called Edinburgh of the Seven Seas.
It's like, it's a rock in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Down, if the map behind you continued and it goes down Africa and then go from like South Africa across to South America and like halfway, it's just middle of nowhere with tiny permanent human population. It's like 15,000 people or something.
Yeah.
And you can go there. This is now veering wildly off penguin genetics, but you can go there, but you have to like book a, it's like you have to go on like a mail, like the ferry that takes the mail. Like just incredibly, incredibly remote. And mm-hmm. it's one of these, I just love to go there. I'd love to go there. So
in with the mail.
Well, with the mail, with let's see how this goes. If I can get in there with penguins, I'll do that. But I'd love to. It just looks, I told you I'd be back. I'm coming up for some quick corrections here on Tristan da Cunha. I said a couple things there off the top of my head, and listening back to it, I just want to make sure that we get all the facts right here at How Many Geese. So take out your pens and papers, mark yourselves at home for this game of Tristan da Corrections on Tristan da Cunha. In order, I said it is not the most remote inhabited place in the world. That was in fact wrong. It is the most inhabited place in the world. It is the most remote inhabited archipelago, beating out the Pitcairn Islands. Number two, I said that Napoleon had something to do with Tristan da Cunha. That was in fact wrong. He was not held in prison on Tristan da Cunha. He was held in prison on St. Helena, which is part of the same overseas territory, but is some 1,500 miles or 2,400 kilometers away. Question three. I said the island had a permanent population of around about 15,000 people. In fact, it is 250 people who live full-time on Tristan da Cunha. So way, way, way smaller than I thought in Edinburgh of the Seven Seas. And lastly, I said that Edinburgh of the Seven Seas was named after the Duke of Edinburgh. This was half right. It is named after the Duke of Edinburgh, but not the recent one, but in fact the second son of Queen Victoria, Prince Alfred the Duke of Edinburgh, when he visited in 1867. So, mark yourselves, score yourselves, and we are going to get back to the penguin chat. Thank you for stopping by Tristan da Corrections on this episode of How Many Geese? Let's take it back to conservation genetics now.
So that's not the only place they are found. So they're found in those islands, and then slightly further south than that, they're also found in Gough Island. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of where they are in the Atlantic. But they're also found in the Indian Ocean, about 7,000 kilometres away from the Tristan da Cunha Islands.
The same species?
The same species.
What are they doing there?
Good question.
And all of the, are they all declining, or are they, are they declining across all of that range, or are some doing better than others? Or
generally, most of them are all declining, but not all of them. So some of the islands are a bit more stable, some are declining, and I think there's one of the ones in the Indian Ocean. I think it's St. Paul is having a very slight increase, but not enough of an increase to counteract the sort of other decreases.
And are we talking about, are these, when we think of penguins, you think of snow and ice and places like that.
And you would be wrong.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm thinking. I'm not thinking that these places are particularly snowy and icy.
No, but most penguins don't live on snowy and icy. That is a Christmas card that's been sold to you and as penguins being on ice.
And you've bought it hook, line and sinker, Badums.
And you know the really annoying thing, actually? I do actually get irate at penguins on Christmas cards because it's not even the right pole.
No, no.
It's just because it's cold.
Yeah.
We'll stick anything on a Christmas card as long as it's cold. but yeah, so these rockhoppers then, they're not out on the ice. They're breeding in areas that have got, are they going into places with trees? Are they, you know, what are they?
It's mostly, well, as the name would maybe suggest, northern rockhoppers. Yeah. They like rocky shores. Okay. So they're sort of more along just on the edges of islands, which is why they're affected by things like climate change, which causes rising sea levels, because that's then affecting the edge of islands, which is generally where they use either for their nests or the way that they move on and offshore to do like fishing and things like that. So they're found on rocky shores and you do literally see them hopping. They hop from rock to rock to rock. And I'm sure you've seen them in the penguin pool doing that. Mm-hmm. They are very, very cute.
And they, so what are their threats? 57% decline. Why?
So some things are the same as you would expect for a lot of species that are in decline. So things like climate change, which they say the sea levels rising, that is an issue. Also sort of linked to that is availability of food. So they primarily eat things like fish and other like marine invertebrates. So they're firstly in direct competition for those resources with humans and other animals, but also things like the change in climate has meant that the availability of these fishes has also changed. So when they do a lot of their big fishing, what they actually do is they will go south more towards where Gough is, because it's just below the subpolar front and that's like a good place to go fishing. But where that temperature is good for those fish to be breeding is going to change as the sea is also changing in temperature. And then when you have extreme events like El Nino, La Nina, how that changes, that's also, they're becoming more extreme each time as well. And that's also causing big fluctuations in fish availability. So that can be a big problem for them. They've also had quite discrete incidences. So there's like oil spills that have happened near Tristan da Cunha because of where they are in sort of shipping lanes. That obviously is that was a discrete incident where there was like a big oil spill that then affected the penguins directly. But there's also like more things that we're just not actually 100% sure exactly what has affected them and how. But we do know that there are incidences of diseases, but these diseases are maybe not seen on every single island. So we don't know how that's going to pan out in the future, because we actually don't know if the penguins move from one island to another. And if they do, are they bringing that disease with them? And is that going to continue to cause a decline in their population?
So on the genetic side, what type of work is the zoo doing?
Just a little bit back from the genetics. RSRSS, along with some of their project partners, wrote a species action plan, which is a conservation document where you take essentially everything you know about a species and everything you don't know about a species. So you say, we know this, we know that these are things that are affecting them, or this is what we know about the ecology and the environment, but what don't we know? And one of the things that we don't know is this movement of penguins between different islands, and because of the disease risk issue, how is that going to affect them? So in terms of how do you do that? It's not that easy to just live out on a remote island and watch every penguin ever and see what they're doing, because as soon as they go below that ocean surface, that's I don't know what penguin that is anymore. So there's been some work done by the RSPB where they've done tagging so they can see what they're doing. But what that gives you is sort of like a snapshot in time of maybe what they're doing over a breeding season or on the off season, or maybe like a whole year, and it'll tell you the sort of movements of individual penguins. But what we don't know is what does that mean in terms of their breeding? Maybe we can see them moving island to island, but are they moving and then breeding on a different island?
Yeah.
Or are they moving just for fishing purposes and then coming back to the colony that they originated from?
Because they're quite long-lived birds as well, aren't they?
Yeah.
So if you've only got a snapshot of a year or so, that's not necessarily telling the whole picture of what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So what we can do with genetic data is it can give us essentially more of like a snapshot back in time. And we can use that information to tell whether penguins have been moving between different islands and if they've been breeding on different islands. So I guess like the elephant in the room question is can they move from the Southern Atlantic Ocean to the Indian Ocean?
Yeah.
And if they did, why would they do that? And is that something that they're doing regularly? Or is it like a one-off incident? Is there like a lot of genetic exchange between those populations?
Yeah.
And then also within those island groups, are they moving? So in the Indian Ocean, there's two islands, Amsterdam and St. Paul. Are they moving between those? And then in the Atlantic, are they moving between the Tristan Islands? Mm. Are they moving down to Gough? Are they moving up? We don't know. So with genetic work, we can get a better idea of if there has been genetic exchange between those different populations.
Because if they hadn't, you said it was it 7,000 kilometres or something like that, the distance between the two main sources of populations? I guess if there isn't a genetic transfer between those two, then you might be looking at the start of speciation or something like that, would you be?
Yes,
potentially,
possibly.
If they've become isolated from each other.
Yeah, it's I mean, that's an age-old question, what is a species? Wow, right, so do we want to get into that?
Well,
I don't think we've got the time for that.
It's just a stupid human concept, isn't it, where we've just tried to draw boxes around things. But yeah, it sounds like it could be. So have you found then whether is this still something that you've been able to answer? Are they mixing? What's going on?
So we haven't finished all of our analysis on that yet, but the preliminary analysis is that, perhaps unsurprisingly, is that the Indian Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean are quite genetically distinct from each other.
Yeah.
I know.
I was really hoping for this to go. And as such, we have discovered a sub-African penguin highway tunneling below the continent.
I'm not sure there's one tunneling beneath the continent.
Overpass.
Yes. I'm not sure. They could hop upstairs. They'd be fine. Yeah. This is where other species would fall down, but
the rock hoppers are well equipped.
But yeah, so we see this difference between the two oceans, which on the face of it is not surprising, given that it's a really large geographical expanse to be moving across. But we do see evidence that there has been movement at some point. So there is some genetic exchange between them. So it's not a case of constantly every year penguins are moving back and forth. It will be a case of every so many generations a penguin is making that movement from one ocean to the other.
Do you think they mean to do that, or are they getting lost? Like, if you're just setting out 7,000 kilometers into the ocean, are they aware of the other penguins out there, or do you think it's more of a sort of castaway event where they're just turning up and being like, oh, thank God there's some penguins here?
I think you need to interview some penguins.
I would need to turn the volume down on that, given how loud they were.
But an actual answer to that is possibly a bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that from the islands in the Indian Ocean that I'm sure it was the RSPB did some tagging, and they found evidence of a tagged bird that just swam to Perth, Australia. It was just
Whoa.
Like, I'm done, I'm out of here, I'm off to Australia.
What?
So like, I think there's whether that was he set out to go to Australia, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
He knew of Australia, but he was definitely...
He knew of Australia.
Guys, you will never guess this place that I've just found.
He's off in his gap here.
He saw some TikTok videos about how much money you can make out there in the mines, and he was like, sick of this little island. I'm popping back up because I've got one other quick correction to throw into the conversation. Heather mentioned here that it was the RSPB who had tagged the bird, which appeared in Perth, Australia. Two quick things on this. First of all, just to make sure that all of the zoo's partners are reflected accurately, she got in touch afterwards to let us know that it actually wasn't the RSPB. They are tagging the birds in the Atlantic Ocean. It is their French partners, CEBC, CNRS, Centre National de Recherche Scientifique, in France. I probably butchered that completely, but it's their French research partners who tagged the birds in the Indian Ocean. And the second point was that it didn't land directly in Perth itself, but it landed in the same longitude as Perth on the coast, but then did end up being looked after by an Australian institution. We're going to get back in with the show now, but we wanted to make sure that all of the zoo's partners in this conservation project were reflected correctly, so just wanted to slip that in. Back to the penguin chat.
That's wild. What do I mean, penguins, I know penguins will travel huge distances, like to go out to feed and stuff. One of my favorite ever pictures is it was taken on the coast of South Africa, and it's a picture of a beach. So imagine sort of a long sandy beach, and there's two ostriches stood on the beach, and then in the foreground, sort of looking down the beach with this, what you can imagine is this perplexed look, is a king penguin that's turned up in South Africa, turned up in a South African beach. And it's one of my favourite meeting of worlds, where you've got these two ostriches and this penguin on the same beach. But that's just, yeah, evidence to the fact that they I guess they must just turn up in, you know, random places.
And do you think they were both looking at a bird that's flying and thinking, you bastard?
From pole, like literally worlds apart, but still united.
Yeah. Same, but different.
They hate everything that can fly. Yes.
Seeing a bat and just thinking, really?
But South Africa is one of the places that they do also turn up.
Do they?
Yeah. So they're called vagrants, mm-hmm. because it's sort of, there's not an established colony in those places. So they've been found in the Falkland Islands, South Africa, the Kerguelen Islands, Australia, and New Zealand. So they are sort of making that sort of circumpolar, subpolar movement.
They're really getting around.
Yeah. Oh. But whether in purpose or whether they've gone out foraging, got a bit lost, and maybe sort of there's quite strong currents in the Southern Ocean as well. So we don't know that the example of the bird that went to Perth is the only one that we've got a direct known. It came from this island and it went to Australia.
That's so. And then do you know what happened to that bird in Perth? Did they fly it back, or did they just leave it to its own devices?
No. So we actually did some genetic analysis on the bird that is in Perth. Because because we don't know what this movement is between islands and between oceans, is the individuals that are turning up in places where they're not supposed to be, but not where we expect to find them, is we don't know where they've come from. And I guess the one that came from the Indian Ocean to Australia kind of makes sense. Mm-hmm. That's the closest island. That's probably where it came from. But the South Africa one is probably the most interesting, because it kind of straddles both sets of islands, where are they coming from, which ocean they're coming from. And there's an aquarium in Cape Town called the Two Oceans Aquarium, and they do the similar to what Perth Zoo has done with this individual that turned up in Perth, is they essentially rehab them. But because of issues with possible disease, we can't release animals back into the wild. One, because we don't know where they came from.
Yeah.
And then two, are you then putting them out with a new disease that they've never seen before?
Yeah.
So what zoos and aquaria do there is they keep them and let them live their best lives in an aquarium with all the fish they could ever want. So they're having a great time.
Exactly.
Yeah. But we did genetic work on that individual from Perth, and it was yes, that matches up with what we see, that it's genetically more similar to other penguins that live in the Indian Ocean. Yeah. But what we found in South Africa is we actually have a mix. So we have some individuals that are coming from the Indian Ocean, and we've got some individuals that are coming from the Southern Atlantic Ocean.
A meeting,
makes sense in a,
That guy who went to Perth really did make it, didn't he?
Yeah.
Because now he's just getting fed. Now he's just getting fed fish, struck out and made it.
Yeah, I was thinking, as aquariums go, having a penguin is a terrible business move.
So you've got to keep it separate.
Yeah.
You've got to keep it separate from the rest. So so we've got all this genetic work. What would be the next step then in trying to improve the fortunes of the rockhopper penguins?
So as part of the Species Action Plan, as I say, we were this is what we know,
this is what we don't know. An important part of that is it's you know, all well and good putting together this document, but you have to make action on it. You have to make conservation management decisions based off of the information you have. So the report was made several years ago, so there will be an update to the report, and then this information that we've got from the genetic data goes back into the revision of the report. So we can now say we've, you know, we had this gap in our knowledge. We now have an understanding that there's some but not a lot of genetic movement between the two different oceans. And then what does that mean in terms of like the disease risk? And that is where you really need a whole host of people with different skills to make those kinds of decisions. So we're feeding in one very specific aspect of it, which is helping to determine like the movement of the penguins. And then that is where you need people who have experience of the penguins, like in the wild, the real boots on the ground type stuff. And that's where they'll say, right, perhaps there's a disease risk on this island, and we can see that there's maybe genetic movement between that island and one that doesn't have the disease. So that becomes a real priority to tackle that disease issue on that island. Yeah. So that's the next step, will be to feed that back in. And then we have to get the expertise from a whole range of different people who work on penguins to come up with what the next best steps are.
And I guess it's literally like knowledge is power. And the more we know about it, the more we can build this whole thing.
Have you ever been out to see the islands?
No. Because as you say, it's very difficult to get to Tristan. Hmm. Our RSPB partners, they do a lot of work. They go out and do like health checks and stuff. I think it's every year, and I am sure that they were like, to go there, they have like a boat that's chartered from Cape Town, and it's like 6 days steam just to get there. So it's a long trip, like you're committing to going.
And when you come back, there's just penguins clinging onto the bow.
That's just how they get there.
Desperate to get out of Tristan da Cunha.
So of the penguins then, which are breeding here, are there any ambitions for kind of wild reintroduction or supporting the wild populations with what Edinburgh has here?
I mean, in terms of having collections, that is one of the purposes of having collections, is that they form what we call an insurance population. But the crux of it is you want to keep your wild populations as healthy as possible, and really being able to address the situation before it gets to that point of having to bring in individuals from collections is really what you want to do. And I think that's why you really want to be like ahead of the curve and making those conservation management decisions when you don't have to. But having that insurance population is there as a sort of like, if it becomes to the point where it's critical and there's so little of them left, then that is certainly an option that you could do. But at the moment, it's very much focused on managing the wild population as a wild population.
And let's hope it doesn't get there either.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that's what is really great about talking to you is, you know, a lot of people listening to this, or just people that visit zoos, I don't think have an appreciation for all the stuff that's going on like this. You know, we're sat in this room where there's all these charts and maps and work that's going on with actual wild populations of these animals as well. You know, zoos and organisations like RZSS aren't just about keeping animals in enclosures and allowing people to come and see them. They're just as much about some of the amazing work that, you know, you guys are doing, studying and conserving stuff in the wild. So I just wanted to ask, as what, you know, you mentioned you work for the Gene Lab, was it?
Wild genes,
that was it. Wild
the
genes.
Best kind of genes, the wild genes.
The wild genes. Very, what's that, very
like
70s.
Will Thornbury's, but genetics.
So have you got any other examples of the sort of stuff that the wild genes projects are doing?
Yep, so many. This is where it's more difficult to think of which ones to talk about.
Yeah, are there any that really sort of pop into your mind as like, oh, that was a cool thing that we did?
Or you've mentioned that you are deeply involved with the Penguin Project, and coming in, I saw a number of kind of names and everything on the wall with a kind of staff poster. Mm-hmm. So do you just do the penguins and sort of your colleagues each lead another one, or do you work across multiple projects at once?
So the way that our department is sort of split into sort of different, not factions, that sounds a bit competitive,
but this battle lines drawn.
There's different areas of expertise. Right. We have the wild genes team, which is sort of split into, we have a programs manager who does overseeing many different conservation projects. Usually any one time we have somewhere between sort of 15 and 20 projects on the go at once. And then in terms of delivering those, we have our lab team. So they work in the wet lab, which I'm not sure if you walked past. It's by the rhino enclosure. Mm. And you'll see it says wild genes, researchers only, and it'll have lots of helixes and things.
And that's
on
the
it.
Wet lab.
Yes.
What makes a lab wet as opposed to a dry lab?
Chemicals.
Okay, right. Okay.
So they process all the samples. So depending on the project, we might have things like feather samples, or we could have bloods, or we could have tissues, or we can have fecal samples. And what they do is they take the actual samples and they process them. So they extract DNA and then they do all of their lab magic to turn that into genetics data. And then that genetics data comes to the analysis team. And we're based in this building, which is a bungalow, not a portico.
Oh, oh, okay. That, yeah, fair enough. Okay. Yeah. That one's on me.
Yeah. I think this room used to be a bedroom. If you were in my office, we were the garage. So... Definitely an ex-bungalow. So we're all based in Wild Genes, but within our department, we also have a field team, and they do all sorts of things like biodiversity action planning. They do breeding for releases of native invertebrates. And also within the conservation department, we have the Saving Wildcats team, which, as you can imagine, has a focus on wildcats.
Yes, yes.
So there's a whole bunch of different things going on at once.
So other than the penguins, what is your maybe like next biggest piece of involvement that you're involved with?
So I work with the field team who are doing some of the native invertebrates breeding. So their current longest going project is the pine hoverfly, which is quite a difference from penguins to pine hoverflies. They're both peas, but they're quite different animals. So they have been breeding them for release for several years now. So they breed them each year and they take flies out to release sites in the Cairngorms where they release them and then they breed in the wild. And they're currently still doing like adding individuals to the wild populations at the moment. The individuals that were used for this breeding program came from a very, very small population in Scotland, and it was the remnant population. That's all that was left. But it was so small that several years you wouldn't see them in the wild. So they've taken individuals from there and then they're using those as their breeding population. But they came from a very small number of founders. That's what we call it, the individuals we take in for breeding programs, the founders. And what we don't know is, have we captured all of the genetic diversity that is in the wild population? Are we maintaining it each year through the breeding program, or do we have some individuals that are more successful breeders and we're only seeing like their genetics being passed down? So that is a project I also do genetic analysis for, is to help them with that and whether they need to make any adjustments to breeding programs and things like that in the future.
Because with things like penguins or other larger animals at zoos, there are of course the stud books, and breeding is very controlled. Is there a pine hoverfly stud book?
Oh yes, there is.
Oh, get in.
So you have named flies?
No.
Oh.
Well, not that's known to anyone else. Okay. Unfortunately for flies, because they're now, it's a very successful breeding program, is that you're sort of into the thousands per year. So that's there's maybe a limit on how many flies you can name. Yeah. So they have codes, but they don't have individual names.
Oh, it's a massive fly family tree.
Yeah. What I do absolutely love about, I think, well, one about this whole field, but two, I think it's a very, like, British UK thing. I don't know, maybe that's, but I just love how, there's a team dedicated to pine hoverflies. Like, I love that. I just love that, like, and I feel it's very, like, in the UK, you get people that are really passionate about little tiny things that other people wouldn't think about. And obviously, you know, penguins. Been talking about penguins. Penguins are very, very easy to love. But I absolutely adore the fact that we've got scientists working on saving and reintroducing something like a pine hoverfly. I just think it's brilliant.
That's because they're equally as cool as penguins.
Yeah, and equally deserve their place.
They should be on Christmas cards.
That's it. Hey,
pine
Scotland's
trees.
Cold.
Scotland's cold. Pine trees. Yeah, mm-hmm. Get them on the Christmas cards. How many geese for getting pine hoverflies on Christmas cards?
Our petition. New campaign.
Yeah, link in the description of this episode.
All right, Dr. Heather, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for having thank me. You.
And that was our special World Penguin.
Cut the drums! We have a special announcement to make. Do you want more Goose? Do you potentially want to be on Goose?
Then we are very excited to be able to say that we are launching a Patreon page, listeners. Up to now, we've been hugely grateful for the donations that people have given us over on our Buy Me a Coffee page, but now we want to give something back.
People ask how many geese, but the answer, it turns out, is in fact more geese. For only £3 a month, you can subscribe to our new Patreon page. Follow the link in the description for more details to get an extra special episode of How Many Geese a Month into your ears.
And that's not all. If you want to aid Roddy in his mission to vanquish every animal on planet Earth, then Patreon members will be entered into a special raffle to become his tag team partner on the main show as you both do battle with one of nature's magnificent creatures in some special editions of our infamous fight segment.
Over the last 3 years, I've faced the fiercest of foes and pheasants. And now we're inviting lucky Patreon subscribers to suit up and enter the arena with me.
Check out the link in the podcast description and head over to the Patreon page for more information and to become one of the flock.
All right, restart the drums and let's end it properly this time.
And that was definitely our How Many Geese World Penguin Day special. A big thank you to Michael, Heather, and of course Sir Niels and the team at Edinburgh Zoo for having us along.
Thank you to everyone for listening, for sharing these episodes and following the Instagram page. And we also want to put a shout out to BirdFi, who are also supporting the show. And if you head over to the Instagram page, you'll see a giveaway which we're running right now for one of their AI bird feeders.
Yeah, get on over there and enter your name into the ring.
So we will be back in a couple of weeks with our next spring special,
I guess. So
early summer special. Yeah.
Back on Tuesday
in a couple of weeks time
with a belter
about camels.
Yeah.
Right, bye.